Welcome to Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau. Brace yourself, we're in Einstein's year and about to face a year-long celebration of one of the best-known scientists in history in countries around the globe, including, of course, the United States. It's the 100th anniversary of the year in which the 26-year-old patent clerk in Bern, Switzerland, published five seminal papers that catapulted him into the limelight of the international community of physicists. It's also the 50th anniversary of his death. To mark these anniversaries, especially the first, I'll be asking Elizabeth Stoddard, professor of physics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, to explain Einstein's papers and their importance. Following that, historian of science William Ashworth will offer us a wonderful anecdote from history that sheds some light on the private Albert Einstein. And Fiona Beattie will tell us about an online exhibit on the scientist created by the American Institute for Physics and the Center for the History of Physics. So stay tuned, but let's begin this program as we do every program by looking at some items of historical interest in the news, this week all related to Albert Einstein. First, one of Einstein's most controversial theories has recently received some scientific support. According to new measurements by the Hubble Space Telescope, it appears that a dark, unseen energy permeating space is pushing the universe apart, just as Albert Einstein predicted it would. Einstein named the energy, whose source remains unknown, the cosmological constant. He posited a kind of anti-gravity force pushing galaxies apart with a strength that did not change over billions of years. The theory received its most stringent test ever with these new measurements. And scientists now acknowledge that what Einstein once called his greatest blunder fits the data better than any other theory. In another item in the news, a note handwritten by Albert Einstein to a university student has been unearthed in Tokyo. The note, dating to 1922, was written and signed by Einstein in response to a letter from a 20-year-old physics student of Tokyo Imperial University and given to him during Einstein's visit to Japan. It includes an equation from Einstein's theory of relativity and a message of friendship. And finally, yet another recent discovery offers us even more insight into the private Albert Einstein. In this case, into a relationship he had during the final years of his life. Her name was Joanna Fentova. She was 22 years younger than Einstein, but she was his regular companion for nearly 2 years. And she took notes, which are now available at the Firestone Library at Princeton University, where Fentova worked and Einstein taught physics. It's well known that Fentova and Einstein were very much an item during the final years of his life, that they sailed together and went to concerts. Einstein also wrote poems to Fentova, and it was scholars' search for biographical information on Fentova that they could include in a publication on those poems that led them to the manuscript, which was in Fentova's personnel file. Now we know that his letters to her were bedecked by jokes and kisses, that he called her several times a week, and that she even cut his hair, if you can imagine that. But the journal also provides us with an image far different from the popular view of Einstein as an absent-minded professor out of touch with the world around him. What we find is a man that was well aware of the politics of the day. It shows that he was suspicious of presidential candidate Adlai Stevenson, whose speeches he found pompous. He referred in private to one visitor, Nobel physicist Werner Heisenberg, the leader of Germany's atomic bomb project during World War II, as a big Nazi. He was scornful of the nuclear arms race, Fentova notes, and that he was critical of the anti-communist crusade of Senator Joseph McCarthy. Next up, I speak with Elizabeth Stoddard about the great physicist's theories, and William Ashworth provides yet another insight into the private world of Albert Einstein. This is Talking History.
Thank you.
With his shock of white hair, woolly mustache, and amiable, distracted air, Albert Einstein has given us our defining image of the scientist. Whether or not that image has any validity, Einstein's genius does, and his reputation as a genius rests to a large extent on his publication of 5 major papers in some 4 months in 1905, 100 years ago this year. We're marking this historic event by taking up the subject of those papers with Elizabeth Stoddard, professor of physics at the University of Missouri at Kansas City. Welcome, Libby.
Hi.
Right. Let's begin by you reminding us of where Einstein was in 1905, what he was doing, especially to make a living.
In 1905, Albert Einstein was 26 years old. He'd completed his college years, and he really had a lot going on. He was a husband. He'd married Mileva, and he was also a father to an infant. She'd had a boy, Hans Albert, the year before. He was also still a graduate student. He was continually submitting dissertations to the University of Zurich for his doctorate. Of course, he had to make a living, so he was working as an examiner in the patent office there in Bern, reviewing applications for cutting-edge devices, many of which were electrical.
Okay, so while working as an examiner in a patent office, he still has time to publish 5 major papers or articles. Let's take them one at a time. I'll read you the titles, and you can tell us briefly what's in each one of them. First one, A New Determination of Molecular Dimensions.
This paper was actually his successful doctoral dissertation, and it really relates to basically when you add sugar to hot tea, you can tell when you stir it that the viscosity changes. So when you add larger molecules to a liquid, it alters the viscosity, and also something that is known about when you add something like sugar to tea, it diffuses, so before long it will be throughout the tea. And you could use the relationship that controls the diffusion and the relationship that controls the viscosity as 2 equations and solve them for 2 unknowns, namely Avogadro's number and the radius of the sugar molecule. So this was his first foray into atomic theory.
Okay. Second paper deals with what we know as Brownian motion, and the title was On the Motion Required by the Molecular Kinetic Theory of Heat of Small Particles Suspended in a Stationary Liquid. It's quite a mouthful.
It is. Let's just call it Brownian motion.
Okay.
But in this paper, he really extends from the previous one, which was, you know, if you could think of sugar in hot water, its motion being determined by its collisions with smaller water molecules, then what if you could find something that was still small enough that each of those collisions with the water molecules could be important to its motion, but big enough that maybe we could see it with our eyes through a microscope? And it turns out that a good example of this would be pollen in liquid water, a small bit of pollen. As a result, if you look at pollen in water, it appears to jitter and vibrate and sort of tremble around in the water. And based on the idea that this motion is due to collisions with water molecules, he calculated what its distance should be from its original location as a function of time. Once this was supported by experiment, no one could really dispute the underlying assumptions in that paper. So that was really a proof of atomic theory, something we take for granted now, that matter is made of smaller atoms and molecules.
Okay, great. If we have time, I want to come back and ask you why any of this is important, but that was a good explanation. The third paper is titled On a Heuristic Viewpoint Concerning the Production and Transformation of Light. First, start by telling us, what does heuristic mean?
Heuristic. It's a wonderful word. It means just think about this as a point. It has to do with a point of study, a point of learning, as a model. So basically, it was just, hey, just consider this. And let's call this paper the photoelectric effect paper, because he was describing a recent experiment in which light was shown on metal, and as a result, some of the electrons in the metal could absorb energy from that light and could escape the metal and fly away with some energy. And it turned out that the energy of these electrons had to do with the frequency of the light and not the intensity of the light. Whereas if something is gathering energy from a wave, it should have to do with the intensity, its resulting energy. So clearly this was a case where light wasn't acting like a wave. And Einstein said, okay, let's say that light is a particle, and that the energy of these particles is proportional to its frequency. And within this model, guess what? You could completely and accurately explain the results of this experiment. So it had to be accepted as a good model. But, of course, you have the paradox. We know light's a wave, and here we have a case where we also know it's a particle.
Okay, good. he's probably best known for his work with relativity. In his fourth paper, he moves in this direction on the electrodynamics of moving bodies.
Right. This is the special relativity paper. And really, this deals with some problems in electricity and magnetism. If you calculate characteristics of a force from one point of view, you might say that two charges are repelled by each other. Whereas a person driving by in a car doing the same calculation would say, no, they're attracted to each other. And somehow it has to be one or the other. And so he combined that idea that all different frames of reference should agree on physical principles and combined that with a recent experimental result, which was that the speed of light is the same to all observers. And basically, from just those two postulates, he derived some very unusual things, which is that a moving object clock will go slower than yours if it's moving relative to you. And because you both agree on your relative velocity, that object will experience space to be contracted. Some very interesting restrictions on time and space due to that speed of light being the same.
Okay, I want to come back to relativity in a moment, but if we move on to the next paper, so we can complete the sequence here, we get into another area for which he was well known, rates the equation E equals MC squared. But that paper was titled, Does the Inertia of a Body Depend Upon Its Energy Content?
Right, the E equals MC squared. It really sprang also from special relativity. The expression for momentum of a particle is usually something's mass times its velocity. But when you do special relativity, there's another factor in there. Since we all agree on velocity, that factor must be multiplying mass. And when you look into what is the structure of that factor, you'll see that the change in something's mass due to its motion is actually equal to its change in energy over C squared. Or you can reorient that and you get E equals MC squared. It's really something that follows from the special rel paper. Okay. But very important results because of that energy there. It could be any type of energy. Things which are hotter have more mass, not just things which are moving. And obviously this led to the understanding of the energy that could be released in an atomic bomb or nuclear energy.
Okay, that gets us through the five basic papers. And we don't have time to cover everything that he did. But let's complete the relativity idea because that's so important in his professional life. 11 years later, in 1916, he publishes another paper and moves us along the way from his ideas on special relativity. Now we're getting into general relativity. What did that have to say?
Well, his studies of general relativity, again, came from a very general idea that he believed in, which was what he called the principle of equivalence, which was, here we are in a room with no windows, and if I drop something, it will accelerate downward at 9.8 meters per second squared. If we weren't on Earth and we were out in outer space on a rocket ship that was accelerating upward at 9.8 meters per second squared, the exact same thing would happen from our point of view. So his idea was that there's no experiment that you can do to determine a gravitational field from just an acceleration. A lot of interesting things come out of this. One of them is, hold on, in the case that you're in outer space, light should fall. Even a photon should fall with no mass. This disagreed with Newton's law. And in the end, in 1919, during an eclipse, they saw that light was bent by the gravitational field of the sun, and Einstein's a genius again.
As a whole, lay people like myself, when we think about physics, we think of generally two individuals, Newton and Einstein. And Einstein is usually credited, when we look at all of his work, with advancing our knowledge beyond Newton. Can you explain that? How did he advance our knowledge in that regard?
Well, you know, they were both extremely important, and they both had things associated with them that were called annus mirabilis, these miracle years. In the case of Newton, it was 1666, where he derived differential calculus, integral calculus, laws of motion, the law of gravitation, and some things that related to optics, all within 1 year. And for Einstein, it was atomic theory, we've got quantum theory, and we have him also developing special relativity and the idea of relativity all in the same year. So really, these men had a lot in common because they moved humanity forward so quickly in a way that we might have gotten there anyway, but it would have taken a lot longer. But they are different in that, for instance, Einstein's idea of general relativity really showed that Newton understood the form of the force, but he didn't understand the how of the force. How did gravitation work? It acted at a distance. Well, Einstein said, it turns out that mass changes space and time, and that determines motion of objects, and that's how the force works. And that Newton's idea was really just a special case of that in the case of weak fields.
In 1921, he won a Nobel Prize for his work in theoretical physics. What specifically was that for?
Well, he got that for the photoelectric effect paper. He'd been repeatedly nominated for this prize. It was pretty much a foregone conclusion that he would get it at some point, and for something, but he'd been associated with so many great things that in the end, the 20s were pretty hot for quantum, and he got it for the photoelectric effect paper, which was really the thing that shone the light, if I might say, on the paradox between the limits of classical mechanics and where quantum must take over.
Incredible accomplishments. You've convinced us as to his genius. But let me ask sort of the question that maybe some of our listeners are asking. Why does any of this matter? Any of these ideas, have they really changed our lives in any way?
Of course I'm going to say yes.
Mm-hmm. I would expect you would.
For instance, from the E equals MC squared, we have nuclear power. We also have nuclear bombs. That has changed the world. From his photoelectric studies, he predicted lasers, and there are lasers now. That changed our world. My favorite example is the GPS system, because lots of people think, special relativity, general relativity, does it matter to us on Earth? And the answer is, well, you know, it is a pretty weak field, but if you need to do very exact calculations, it matters a lot. And in the GPS case, these satellites need to know exactly where they are so they can know exactly where you are and tell you where you are. So their clocks have to be very exact. And as a result of the fact that they're moving, their clocks are slow due to special relativity, but also as a result of the fact that they're in a weaker gravitational field, their clocks are too fast by general relativity, and both of these corrections absolutely must be made in order for this system to work. Actually, the GR effect is greater than the special relativity effect. So this is a case where we really see these things as being important in our technological era.
Okay. It's a big year, big celebration. It's an opportunity for physics to really make something of this and get its place in the public eye, because we know that we need to attract more people, young people especially, into the sciences. You anticipating a lot of activity around this?
Well, we are. We're planning right now for a big open house for several departments, hopefully, at UMKC to be involved in. There are many departments who have been touched by Einstein. In addition, Linda Hall may also participate in our open house in the fall. So since his last paper was in September, we felt like that might be a place where we can put that open house, but we'll have to wait and see how everything works out.
Right, and I understand from my reading that this is going on profession across the country.
Yes,
and
is.
Even in Europe, for that matter.
Yes, it so. Is. This is being widely celebrated, especially by physicists.
Great. Very good. Okay, well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
I've been speaking with Elizabeth Stoddard, professor of physics at UMKC. This is Talking History.
I believe that Gandhi's views were the most enlightened of all the political men in our time. We should strive to do things in his spirit, not to use violence in fighting for our cause, but by non-participation in anything you believe is evil.
In our historical news of the week segment, we reported on two recently discovered documents that shed light on Albert Einstein, the man, the personal side of this very public figure. The first was a note he wrote to a university student. The second was the journal of Einstein's last girlfriend. Our guest commentator this week, William Ashworth, adds another personal element to this picture, a letter Einstein wrote to a 12-year-old girl who inquired of him if scientists prayed. Ashworth is a professor of history at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He specializes in the history of science.
In 1936, a young Sunday school student wrote Einstein a letter asking whether scientists pray. Einstein replied, "Scientific research is based on the idea that everything that takes place is determined by laws of nature, and therefore this holds for the actions of people. For this reason, a research scientist will hardly be inclined to believe that events could be influenced by prayer, by a wish addressed to a supernatural being. However, it must be admitted that our knowledge of these laws is only imperfect and fragmentary, so that, actually, the belief in the existence of basic all-embracing laws in nature also rests on a sort of faith. All the same, this faith has been largely justified so far by the success of scientific research. But, on the other hand, everyone who is seriously involved in the pursuit of science becomes convinced that a spirit is manifest in the laws of the universe, a spirit vastly superior to that of man, and one in the face of which we, with our modest powers, must feel humble. In this way, the pursuit of science leads to a religious feeling of a special sort, which is indeed quite different from the religiosity of someone more naive. This is a remarkable document, not least because Einstein, a world-famous figure, wrote it by hand to a 12-year-old girl he had never met. It reveals an Einstein we seldom see described. Einstein was one of the most humble, spiritual, and supremely moral beings that one could hope to encounter. And yet he stood completely outside of any institution that seeks to regulate our moral or spiritual lives. His morality was not legislated or mandated, but forged in the fires of his own soul. In 1950, Einstein received a letter from a Brooklyn minister asking for any kind of a personal testament that he could treasure. Einstein replied, "The most important human endeavor is the striving for morality in our actions. Our inner balance and even our very existence depend on it. Only morality in our actions can give beauty and dignity to life. To make this a living force and bring it to clear consciousness is perhaps the foremost task of education. The foundation of morality should not be made dependent on myth nor tied to any authority, lest doubt about the myth or about the legitimacy of the authority imperil the foundation of sound judgment and action." In an age when we often let institutions and political parties determine our views on many matters, Einstein teaches us that perhaps there are other and better ways to realize our humanity.
You've been listening to William Ashworth, Professor of History of Science at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. And finally, as we do most weeks on this program, we close by directing you to either a real or virtual site where you can learn more about the subject of the program, in this case, Albert Einstein. Talking History's Fiona Beatty is here to tell you about the online exhibit, Albert Einstein, Image and Impact.
In this, the centennial of Einstein's miracle year, the information highways and byways have much to offer. Of these, I chose a remarkable online exhibit, Albert Einstein, Image and Impact, created by the American Institute for Physics and the Center for the History of Physics. There's over 100 images and texts, bibliography, extensive links, and special features, such as the opportunity to listen to Einstein himself explaining the equivalence of energy and matter, the famous E equals mc squared. For an overview, there's basic facts and chronology, or for an in-depth visit, there's the option to read essays by historians on diverse topics, from Gerald Holton's Einstein's World View to David Cassidy's analysis of Einstein on Brownian motion. Visitors can choose from 8 themes, each with explanatory texts, photographs, and links. Einstein's Formative Years, The Great Works, 1905, World Fame, Public Concerns, Quantum and Cosmos, Nuclear Age, Science and Philosophy, and his essay, The World as I See It. And a mere mouse click away is a link to many other excellent sites, such as the World Year of Physics, with information about events celebrating 2005 in Europe and America. If you're curious about Einstein and his legacy, check out the American Institute for Physics website at www.aip.org.
The hydrogen bomb appears on the public horizon as a probably attainable goal. Its accelerated development has been solemnly proclaimed by the president. If successful, radioactive poisoning of the atmosphere and hence annihilation of any life on Earth has been brought within the range of technical possibility.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. We'd like to thank Mars Sound Archives and the Miller-Nichols Library at the University of Missouri, Kansas City for the Einstein recordings we used in today's show. We invite your comments on the show and suggestions for future programs. Just send them to us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Fiona Beattie, producer, Alex Smith, our studio engineer. For more information on Talking History or the OEH, visit our website at oeh.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.